In the Philadelphia Navy shipyard in the year 1943, the USS Eldridge and her crew involved in a top-secret military project called the Philadelphia Experiment. The objective was radar invisibility. The result was a disaster, producing an unimaginable series of events, and only a few men survived this experiment, two of whom had jumped from the ship and landed mysteriously on the Army base at Montauk. And that's in Long Island. That was the year 1983, 40 years later. And this 40-year time in space sleep seemed to take just moments. And that's part of Al Bielek's intriguing life story. He's with us for the next couple hours. Al, how are you?
I'm fine.
It's been a while. You know, when we last talked almost 2 years ago, someone had told me that you might have been involved in a car accident or something after that.
Yes, I was. I moved to Florida, and then there was a car accident in which I did not appear to be injured at the time, drove the car home, and that night after dinner I had a strange tingling sensation on my right side. I did not know what it was. 5 days later, I found out what it was. It was the beginnings of a stroke. That was when the next 5 days later in the morning, I rolled out of bed on the floor and couldn't get up.
Well, you do much better now, I hope.
Oh, much.
Excellent. Al, what is the latest now since the Philadelphia experiment of 40 years ago? Are things, has anything changed in terms of the concept of this experiment or things that we might not have been aware about of a couple years ago?
Very little. The experiment, of course, took place. The original concept was from Dr. Nikola Tesla, honorary doctorate, and it was his idea. He sold it to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 32nd President of the U.S. Roosevelt, through the Navy, supplied the money to fund the project. And he did the initial work, which was very successful on the first test, the first one being in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in 1940, using a small ship with a lot lower power than was required for the Eldridge. And, of course, there was also an interim test in which they were going to go to a battleship, and that was the point where Tesla bowed out. He says he wouldn't be responsible for killing sailors, but he said the power level was much too high with the concept of how to do it at that time. And so he bowed out, and Dr. John von Neumann took over, continued Tesla's approach, and increased the power somewhat. The first test on 15 July was quite successful with no side effects. And then, of course, there came the fatal test on 12 August 1943 with severe side effects. And I might add, the one of the big problems involved with this story is the concept that this was the USS Eldridge that was involved. It was not the Eldridge. The name was adopted later. By what means and how, I don't know, because there was an Eldridge launched in 1943, August 27th or 8th, from the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
Right.
And it went to sea. It never took part in the Philadelphia experiment. It was never in the Philadelphia yard. And there's a long and mysterious story there, because I ran down all the pictures I could find out of the archives, and they show two ships. There is a DE-173, which is well known, and there is a 173, which is an entirely different ship and structure, with a knife plow front end, different superstructure, a number of different appurtenances were different. And that may have been the ship that was used. But my latest information is that the real ship that was used was supplied by the German government to the United States, because it was originally intended to be a joint project between the United States government and the Germans. See, we were not at war with Germany in 1940 or 41. They turned that ship over to us in January or February of 1940.
I understand. Okay.
And we were on very good relations then. Of course, we got pulled into the war through the back door of Japan attacking Pearl Harbor. And then the liaison continued until sometime in mid-43, because I was part of that liaison with the German, not a naval officer, a German aviator that came over to Long Island. And you can tell some wild stories about the German submarines coming up for the weekend off of Montauk Point on Long Island to sun themselves, charge their batteries. They'd wave at the people on shore, and the people on shore would wave back. It was a crazy war.
Some of the Germans even went ashore, didn't they?
They did, yes.
Unbelievable.
Now, it's unbelievable, is right.
In that time period, Al, you were someone else, right?
Yes, my original name was Edward Cameron.
Had a brother?
Father was Alexander Duncan Cameron, Sr.
Okay.
And he was in the Navy himself during the period prior to and overlapping World War I and through the time about 1930 when he was retired from the Navy because of a physical disability.
The ship that you were on as Ed Cameron was which one?
Which was a German ship.
Okay.
So we have photos of the interior of that ship. I have them in my collection. And the interior ready room picture is much larger than those who investigated later to the real Eldridge and found that the real Eldridge didn't have a ready room that large and could not possibly have been that one because it didn't match.
Why did they or how did they try to ease in the Eldridge ship in this whole project?
I cannot answer that one fully. I don't know, except there was a great effort on the part of the Navy after this thing was over and they had so many disasters to cover the whole thing up, and they adopted the name of a ship which was known to have been built and existed, and they wanted to cover up the fact that the real ship that was used in the experiments was not an American ship.
Tell me.
They conveniently, someplace, adopted the name the Eldridge, which was a provable American ship having been built in the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
During the experiment, Al, the disastrous experiment, tell us what happened. Paint us a picture of what things were like.
Okay, well, we had a very successful test, and I said in July. Then they decided to change the requirements somewhat. They didn't require full optical invisibility. They only wanted radar invisibility because the thinking at that time was, you see, we had no satellites then, and none of the other long-range navigational systems
right.
we have now. The statement was made that we do not want optical invisibility. We only want radar invisibility because if we have a convoy at sea at night and we have optical invisibility, we may ram one of our own ships.
Sure.
So don't want complete invisibility. We just want the Germans to be fooled into not being able to see our ships with by means of the radar. They had good radar at that time. So that was one of the reasons why they changed somewhat the requirement and cut it back, so that it was only a requirement for free radar invisibility. So in the 43 test of 12 August, that was a requirement as modified. It will only be radar invisibility. That made some change in the requirements as to how the whole system was set up. But nevertheless, 3 days before the 12 August test, virtually everybody in the crew was a volunteer crew. And, of course, I was there and Duncan was there, and we were the ones chosen because of the fact we both had PhDs in physics.
And were you all aware of what was happening?
We were aware that something was wrong.
Okay.
We both had that gut feeling, as did some of the other sailors. And we used to bail out of the back gate of the Navy Yard to a diner that was down the road about half a mile from the back gate and go in there at night sometimes and have coffee all night. It was open 24 hours then. And we would discuss this, and we all had this strange feeling that something was wrong, but we didn't know what. Neither Duncan nor I could put our fingers on anything wrong with any of the equipment. It was not the equipment. The equipment was working fine insofar as its design projection and its design parameters were concerned. What went wrong was the fact that due to the nature of the way the field was set up, and actually to describe it briefly, Tesla's original concept was to have a closed field like an egg around the ship, which would seal it off against any outside possible interference.
Totally engulfing the thing.
Totally engulfing the ship.
All right.
And there would be no problem to still have the invisibility that way, but it would lock out any outside interference of any kind. Well, pressure of the war and all of that, get something done, get it going as quickly as possible. He relaxed that requirement to allow a toroidal field, like a donut with a hole in the middle, and the Eldridge or the ship that was used would be in that hole, and it would be surrounded by a field which was in the shape of a donut.
Okay.
That left an open hole in the middle, and that is what happened because the Montauk project, taking place 40 years later, overlapping a period of time, but particularly it was running on 12 August 83, and that was because of help we had from alien groups and how to make the whole thing work properly to what we wanted in 83, they had their own agenda, which was agreed to by the government, and they set up the requirement through channels that the test, the final test, would take place on 12 August 43, because the 12 August 83 is exactly 40 years later, and there was a synchronicity system involved here, if I may call it a system, a synchronicity aspect involved, in that you were dealing with the time fields of Earth and the fact that there's a phase shift every 20 years. And if you had it on a 40-year point, it was the maximum point where the Earth's fields locked in with maximum intensity, and there's a lot of very strange physics involved.
And it was like a closing window, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually an open window, which caught the Eldridge. Had the test been one day later or one day earlier, this problem would never have developed.
Right, the window would have been closed.
That's right.
Okay.
And so what happened was the aliens had this thing turned on. They were using this to create a rift in the time field 40 years wide to allow certain of their ships from their home base to come in. They weren't after us. They weren't attacking us. They were pursuing a war which was going on in the solar system, involving certain of their ships and certain other enemies who we knew nothing about at that time, and who knows if we know anything about them now. But nevertheless, they got the ships through by creating that rift in the time field so that they could get their ships through, and that rift could only be created by locking up the two experiments, Montauk and Philadelphia experiments.
All right, so causing
the huge rift in the time field 40 years wide.
All right, so a couple things were going on then. Not only was the experiment actually occurring for radar invisibility, but in 1983, this alien intervention needed to take advantage of the experiment as well.
Right. Now, I might add, of course, that those aliens were not somebody from outside and far away in space. They were all there by the invitation of the United States government. They were working on various projects for the government. They were helping us with our projects. And it was just that their price was they wanted to be able to use the Montauk facility for their own projects periodically. And that was agreed to in advance by the government not knowing anything about what they were letting themselves in for.
All right, let's get back to that in a second, because that's important when you make that time leap. So the experiment occurs. There's a disaster. Now, what's happening to the crew before you and Duncan apparently jump ship? What's happening to the crew that was on that ship?
Several things. One, the field strength, as embodied by the revised equipment by Dr. John von Neumann, was so high that Tesla was afraid of it himself. And he said there might be a problem with dead crew members. What happened was it completely discombobulated the crews on deck, not those below deck, but the ones who were on deck who were stationed there as observers, such that they became partly invisible themselves. They also shifted. Now, no one on board that ship was supposed to become invisible, but the ones on the deck did become partially invisible because we were very close to and inside the fields were being generated in order to produce the invisibility effect. It affected them psychically. It affected them neurologically. It affected their total body feel such that they started fading in and out of visibility. And then the ship was not locked exactly to that one location. It was not anchored by any anchor or anchor chain to the water below in the lower part of the harbor. It wasn't even in the harbor. It was downriver. The ship was supposedly stationary, but it was drifting.
What made you and Duncan jump off the ship?
What made us jump off the ship was, first of all, we were running the equipment. Everything turned on and started to work the way it was supposed to. But then we started to get some very strange electric fields inside the control room, which it shouldn't have been. We were getting high-voltage walkovers from equipment which did not and could not produce high voltage. And it was inside the control room. The electron tubes were banks and banks of 606G tubes, which those who are familiar with tubes will know what model and type that was.
Yeah.
It was quite prominent then. And those things were starting to get brighter and dimmer. The heaters weren't holding constant level. And then this strange high-voltage phenomena seemed to develop, and there was some kind of strange arc over. Looking back at it, I can say it was not an electrical phenomenon. It was an etheric phenomenon which manifested in an electrical manner to us at that time. So we saw this. We were told prior to this experiment, if anything ever goes wrong, and we could not get any radio communication, that was shut off at the time, we said, frankly, we are on our own, and what we do is up to us.
Okay.
So we decided at that point, well, we better shut the equipment down because it's out of control. We can't control it. So we went for the control knobs and everything else, and they were frozen. We couldn't move a thing. So at that point, with this electrical phenomena, or what we took as an electrical phenomena, continuing to get worse, we simply didn't know what to do, and we finally got the bright idea as, well, there's nothing we can do in here. Let's go out on deck. And we did. We opened the bulkhead door and went out on deck. We saw sailors milling around in a very strange manner. Both of us got the idea, let's go to the railing of the ship, and we both got the idea simultaneously. And looking back on it, it was a little strange. We both had the same idea at the same time, jump overboard, because that was, in essence, in violation of orders. But, of course, we were told that we'd be on our own.
Could you see the shape of that donut, whatever it might have been, in that green fog or mist that we hear so much about?
We could see the fog, but we could not see any kind of a donut field. We couldn't see the shoreline. We couldn't see anything beyond approximately, well, say about 6 feet beyond the railing.
Could you see the water down below from the top of the ship? You couldn't even see that. Okay.
No, the fog was so thick. When we jumped overboard, we were doing it on faith that the water was there.
Yeah.
And, of course, we never hit the water because the water wasn't there.
So you both jump.
Right.
And where do you end up?
We end up going through a very strange tunnel-like fields. And we were in sight of each other at the time. We finally wind up with a landing on our feet on dry land. Inside of a military complex, because we recognized the chain-link fence as a military fence.
Okay.
We had no idea where we were. We had no idea what was going on.
You're wearing your 1943 uniform,
right,
I guess.
Yes.
Okay.
We were both officers in the Navy, so we both had our officers' uniforms. We land there, then suddenly, in a matter of seconds, there was a blinding searchlight beaming down on us. From what we found out later, it was a helicopter. And so the helicopters, we were told this later after we were taken below deck. Below deck, I said below ground level, and we didn't know what the craft was that had this blinding searchlight on us, but when the MPs came to get us, we knew what MPs were.
Sure.
And they grabbed us and took us to a building. We went in, and the elevator door opened. We went down several levels, and finally the door opened down where we were, and we went out and received military and civilian personnel running aground in this underground facility, and an elderly gentleman in a gray business suit coming towards us. We didn't recognize at all. And finally he comes up to us and says, gentlemen, I've been expecting you. I'm Dr. John von Neumann.
Whoa, from 40 years earlier.
Yeah.
Now he's 40 years old.
Well, we look at him and he says, you're who? I said, I'm Dr. John von Neumann. I said, you couldn't possibly be. We left him an hour or so ago. He's a much younger man. And he says, gentlemen, I am the same John von Neumann you knew in 1943. This is 1983. And you're in the underground facility of Montauk Point.
And he knew that two sailors jumped ship.
He knew that we were going to jump ship and wind up there because it's a very convoluted aspect. We gave him a full report of what happened, and eventually that report he wrote up was filed. Of course, eventually he told us we had to go back to the ship, and we had to literally destroy the equipment any way we could, axes or whatever.
All right, hold that thought, Al. We'll be right back with you, but very quickly. At that point, you're still Ed Cameron, right?
That's correct.
All right, we'll be back with Al Bielek, or Ed Cameron, in just a moment. Okay, Al, so now you and Duncan have jumped ship. You've somehow gone forward in time 40 years. You land at Montauk Island. And waiting for you is the scientist from 40 years prior to.
Right.
He knows you're on the way.
Yes. And he told us we were in 1983 and we didn't believe him. And he gave us a Cook's tour, or at least part of it, to see electronic equipment, computers, and such items, which did not exist in 1943. And he says, well, I got some business to conclude. I have to go to my office. I'll come back and get you. Here, sit down in the lounge and watch TV for a while. So we did. We sat down and watched large screen color TV. In 1943, there was nothing larger than a 10-inch black and white tube. So we were looking at this and watching the program matter. We were seeing freeway traffic jams and discussions about man and the moon and the Cold War and all this. And I said, after a while, we looked at each other and said, maybe the old man was right.
Yeah.
So maybe we are in 1983 because none of this exists in our time we were at. So we look him up before he called us back. We found where he was in his office, and they said, well, maybe you're right. There's some very strange things here. He says, gentlemen, we got a problem. And I said, okay, what's that? He says, well, you jumped ship off the Eldridge. The Eldridge had disappeared into hyperspace because it interacted between its field generators and what we have here at Montauk, and it yanked the Eldridge out of its other harbor and out of its normal location in space-time, and it's floating around in hyperspace, and we have to get it back to where it came from, and there's only one way we can do that. We can't shut the equipment off on the Eldridge. You got to go back there and shut it off any way you can, or smash it, whatever.
Did you tell him, look, the dials are frozen, for crying out loud?
Oh, we told him everything. He says, well, we don't... He said to us, he says, you have to go back. He says, no, we don't know how we got here, just how are you going to send us back there? And he said, that's very easy, gentlemen. Here at Montauk, we have complete control over space and time. We can send you anywhere we want in space or in time. And he says, we'll send you back there with radiation-proof suits, and we will, when you land, you will take off the suits, and you'll go find suitable appurtenances, axes, whatever, and start chopping up the equipment. It's certain items you don't destroy, but the rest of it, you chop it up until the generators start to wind down. So when you hear the generators winding down, then you know it's going to be over shortly.
And they were going to be able to plop you right down on the ship?
And they did.
Okay.
So we did as instructed, and we smashed the equipment, and eventually we heard the main generators winding down, and at that point we said, well, I guess it's over. So at that point, we went back out on deck.
1943.
Well, we weren't quite in 43 yet. The transition was in process.
Okay, okay.
Well, we knew in 43 when the field effects and all of the fog cleared. Then we could see that we were back at the starting point. But before that happened, we saw sailors running around on the deck, some of them fading in and out of visibility.
Were some of them stuck? Almost in.
I was just about to get to that.
Okay.
There were two sailors stuck in the deck, frozen in the metal, their bodies intermingled with the steel.
Oh, my God.
Then there were two more upright. One of them was our younger brother, Jim, who had enlisted in the Navy in beginning of after Pearl Harbor in the beginning of the war. And he was partly in the bulkhead, the upright, and partly not in it. The fourth man was there, the only one to survive naturally. He had his hand stuck in the steel. They cut his hand off and gave him an artificial hand later, but he's the only one of that group that survived. Below deck, there wasn't any problem. It was all up on top side.
Now, why didn't it affect anything down on the bottom?
The steel of the ship shielded everybody from the magnetic field effects from the generator.
Okay.
See, in those days, the strips were still all steel. Sometime after World War II, they started converting to aluminum hulls.
Right.
Because they were lighter and they were speedier. But in any case, these other sailors were visibly fading in and out of visibility, running around, and just couldn't figure out what was going on with them. Well, that was a long story. That was one of the problems. But, as I say, after we were there and the crew, they couldn't raise anybody in the captain's head and the captain's mast and the captain's quarters at all, couldn't raise anybody on the ship radio-wise, so they finally sent aboard a boarding crew. With two-way radio, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The boarding crew reported the sailors buried in the steel deck, and they couldn't locate the captain. And finally, they roared back and says, well, we need another boarding crew to bring the ship back from here back into the yard. So they sent a second boarding crew, and which had the facilities and the capability of running the ship and bringing it back into the yard, whereupon everybody was ordered off the ship, and the Navy made an inspection, and the Navy decided to have a four-day-long board of inquiry, in which they asked everybody questions, including myself. Now, I have to add, at the point where we reappeared in the harbor and weren't quite sure yet where we were really in the harbor, Duncan took one look at Brother Jim and buried in the deck, not the deck, I'm sorry, the bulkhead, as I did. He went heading for the railing and looked back at me like, well, wasn't I coming along? I didn't. I decided to stay there and try to console James until he died. And Duncan jumped overboard, and he found out later he wound up back in someplace in the 80s as part of the Montauk Project.
So he was not
there to back up any of my testimony.
He went off on his own?
Yes, he
okay.
went off on his own.
All right.
And, of course, after everybody was taken off the ship, the Navy had their Board of Inquiry. I told my version of the story.
Did they believe you?
No.
No.
Absolutely did not. I told John von Neumann, and he did, because this, again, was John von Neumann, 43, And he did half believe me. And he says, we'll discuss this later. So the Navy, after all of this, decides, and of course all of the major equipment went aboard. The ship was burned out and had been chopped, wrecked, and had burnouts, electrical. And the Navy decides, well, we need to do one more test. We'll replace the equipment. They already had spares built, ready to go on other ships. They said, we'll rip out the burned-out equipment, and we'll rebuild it. We'll do another test. So they did another test in mid-late August.
Did you volunteer?
Sorry, in mid-late October.
Did you volunteer for that one, too?
No.
Oh, okay. I don't blame you.
Mid-late October, down much further down in the outer harbor, at night, anchored the ship, so to speak. Actually, they didn't anchor it, but they took it down there with a tool, the crew off, ran the equipment by remote cables so they could turn everything on by manual sequence from another ship. They did that. The ship went invisible. And then about 20 minutes later, it came back from wherever it was, and it was burning. It was on fire. At that point, the Navy decided to wash their hands of the whole project. Says, well, we got to re-equip the ship. They were so short of ships, and they were grabbing anything they could to send it out to sea. And so they re-equipped the ship with normal equipment, left what was left of the other equipment on board, and put a normal crew on board, and the ship went to sea. Now, that ship that did turn up later, after World War II was over, a lot of Navy ships were put into mothballs.
Right.
And the real Eldridge, the DE-173, wound up, I got this from a sailor who was on board the Eldridge, called me some years ago, and says, I want you to know I was on board the Eldridge. He says, we were out in the Pacific, came back via Honolulu, I hitched a ride from Pearl Harbor back to the San Diego operating base, and then I said the ship was going to be decommissioned. I took a ride, and it was perfectly legal to do that. The ship was moved to James River Yard in Florida to be decommissioned, which it was in 1947.
The real Eldridge.
The real Eldridge.
Okay.
In the meantime, the one which we call the Eldridge, which I did finally run down some of the history of it, but I can't prove it.
And that's the one you were on?
Yeah.
Okay.
That one was given to the Greeks, along with a sister ship, for training purposes in 1951. And photos turned up in 1985 of this group of ships given to by the United States government and the United States Navy to the Greeks for training purposes, and which some Greek photographer took a long series of pictures, and they wrote a story about the Eldridge. They called it the Eldridge, and it went into the Greek Playboy. The pictures were good. They showed the real ship, and it was not the Eldridge. There were differences, very monumental differences, between the German ship, because it was a German ship.
Did this go to Aristotle Onassis?
No.
No, okay.
No, it was eventually recommissioned. They had to clean up the rust, make repairs to the ship, and they finally eventually had to tow it across the Atlantic back to the Navy yard in Washington, D.C. It was cleaned up, rebuilt. And a friend of mine who had access to the records, we'll put it that way, I will not give his name because he had a lot of trouble for doing this for me, he found out that the ship was cleaned up, recommissioned, and the Navy kept it at their Washington, D.C. Navy Yard as sort of a show ship. And it was all cleaned up and very pretty, and he looked at it. He told me about it. I did not have access to the websites. He had a high-level clearance, and he had the could do that and force his way into it and see the pictures of it. He says, I'd like to make copies of these pictures, but it's eyes-only stuff, and all I can do is look at it. He said, this is the ship that was used in the real Philadelphia experiment. And
Could you verify that when you looked at it?
I could not. I was not allowed to see the pictures. I didn't have the clearance.
Oh, they never showed it to you. Okay.
No, I never saw the pictures of it. But he did, and he said, yes, this is the ship that was used in the real Philadelphia experiment and in the real ship, which was not the Eldridge. And it was given that number, 173, as a cover-up.
All right, now let me ask you this. I'm interviewing right now Al Bielek. The guy who went back was Ed Cameron. At what point did you become Al Bielek?
Years later, I remained in the Navy to kaleidoscope a lot of work.
Because you're close. How old are you now, Al? You're about 80?
Well, according to my official record as Al Bielek, I'm 77.
Okay.
But actually, I'm over 100.
You're over 100 years old?
I was born as Ed Cameron in 1916.
All right, now you're gonna have to tell me what happened.
Yes.
How'd you become Al Bielek?
I joined the Navy after I finished my schooling. Dyke Duncan, we enlisted together in New York, became part of the Navy operations. We both had eventually, not at the time we signed on. We signed on as lieutenants, and we eventually worked our way up in rank to the rank of captain because of our education, training, and what they wanted us for. So Duncan disappeared. I remained in the Navy. Eventually, they sent me up to Los Alamos Laboratories because John von Neumann was there on the bomb project, and he requested through the Navy channels they would like to have me work with him because I was quite proficient in mathematics then, and he wanted somebody to back up the work he was doing.
And you're still at Cameron then, right?
I'm still at Cameron then.
All right.
So I was there 42 through 45. Then I was on some other projects, and eventually, I married in the meantime, by the way.
Okay.
I had five kids. And eventually, the Navy pulled me out of what I was on there at Los Alamos because I got into some violent arguments with Ed Teller over the bomb, and he wanted to produce the hydrogen bomb. And I says, your math is flawed. You can't predict the yield on this thing. Oh, he blew up when I said his math was flawed. Eventually, he got the credit for it, but he did not himself develop the hydrogen bomb. That was given to some other one of the younger physicists in there. There was a contest as to who would come up with the best proposal or the most acceptable proposal to build a hydrogen device. And this was admitted by Dr. Teller in a radio interview many, many years earlier than now, but long after this whole period was over, that he did not develop the bomb. He took credit for it.
He took credit for it, yeah.
Originally his proposal.
Okay.
So he was given credit for it. But I got in arguments with him. I was provincially invited to leave the lab. I went into other projects with the Navy, and that's a little long story, but eventually
still,
I was sent by the Navy to the Pentagon.
Still as Ed Cameron.
As Ed Cameron.
All right.
And in 1953, there was a big argument and question about what to do with me. I knew too much about secret projects in the Navy, and they wanted to get rid of me, but they already realized that they couldn't do the normal number, which would be to go out and give me the firing squad number. See, I had been traveled to time too much, and they knew that eliminating me that way would cause major disturbances in the time field. So they finally came up with a plot. We'll use some of the equipment at Montauk in 1983, which they captured from the Germans, for age regression. It was an experimental system, but it was workable, in which they could physically age regress a person back. Normally, they didn't take them back earlier than 21, but they did try to do an experiment on me to see if they could take me back to being an embryo, not an embryo, but about a nine-month-old kid. Literally, physically shrink me down to a nine-month-old kid, and of course, wiped my memories totally before this happened.
And this is in 53?
This was in 53 this was done to me.
All right.
And I was sent back to 1927 to the Bielek family to replace a real Al Bielek, who apparently had, according to the story, got sick and went to the hospital and died in the hospital. So I was offered as an adoption substitute. And, of course, I inherited the name Al Bielek.
What an incredible story. Without, well, how did the memory come back to you then?
That was many, many, many years later. At that time, I had no memory of what was going
on. So as you were growing up, you were
Al Bielek, not knowing any better.
You didn't know anything about the Philadelphia experiment?
No.
Nothing. Okay.
Nothing. And this went on. I had an intense interest in the Philadelphia experiment in the period of the 60s and the 70s and became connected with Ivan Sanderson when he was running his operation in New York, as well as book publishing and
right,
a farm
okay.
over in Long Island, not Long Island, I'm sorry, in New Jersey, Hope, New Jersey. And I was a member of his staff at that time. I used to go visit regularly. I had a great interest in it, and he had some files on it, but he could never get the truth out of the Navy. Was there a Philadelphia experiment? Yes. That's all they would tell him. And they wouldn't give him any details, whatever.
They still won't?
No. They still deny that it ever happened.
Right.
Now they won't admit it at all that it ever happened. But I was a part of that, and what happened was, eventually, the movie, The Philadelphia Experiment, was produced.
I remember that.
And I saw it one night on a large screen wall projection TV, and I hadn't heard of it. I'd not seen it before. This was in January, I believe, of 1984. The movie came out, if I remember correctly, in 83, and went around the circuit and all over, and it was pulled sometime after. Let's see, no, it wasn't 84, so it was 86. They went to the British bought the rights to it, then they started producing videos of it, and the videos came to the U.S., and some of the TV stations got a hold of them and started showing them. And I saw it that one Saturday night. It hit me quite hard because I felt that I was involved.
You just didn't know how.
I didn't know how right at that point. 2 days, 3 days later, the memory started to come back. Now, other people at the time thought, are you sure that you were really part of it? Well, I felt for certain I was, but when I started lecturing on the subject, because I dug some information out, and I kept running into people who remembered me from the time of the experiment, who remembered me from Los Alamos Laboratories, the fact that I was Ed Cameron, that I was a physicist in Los Alamos, and one chemist who was there remembered me very well when he was living at that time down in New Mexico in Las Cruces, and then we went out for dinner one night and talked about the whole business. And he says, I remember you very well. You were there at Los Alamos. But he said, you were in a different department than I was in. He said, we were all working on the bomb project. Well, from there on, I went through some other regression improvement techniques and brought back more and more memories, and then I ran into more and more people who remembered me. And, of course, I ran into Duncan and then Preston Nichols, and eventually more of the story came back, and eventually I found corroboration from other people.
Because there is a person now named Duncan Cameron out here somewhere, right?
Yes.
Who is your brother?
He is my half-brother.
Okay.
Legally, he is a half-brother. They're different mothers.
Does he recall this story?
Yes, he finally recalled it. He recalled it under hypnosis. Preston, he had a lot of problems from the Montauk Project, which he became part of, and I also became part of. But he had so many problems psychologically that he was put under hypnosis for regression. He was taken from his then-current age back to the period of the Montauk Project until he was about the age of 12. Everything was, say, gelled coherently. And then he was asked in a hypnosis to go back to an age earlier than 12, and he jumped back to a time when he was on the Eldridge, or what was called the Eldridge. He said it was part of this thing called the Philadelphia Experiment.
Oh,
there were people here I know now under a different name. Al Bielek was there.
He was there. Hold that. Take your phone calls. A few more questions for Al here first, if we can. Al, you brought up something about aliens when you were popped into 1983. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a rather long story, but what happened was, of course, when World War II ended, and there were a lot of German scientists brought into the U.S. under Operation Paperclip, they went to Brookhaven National Laboratories, and they were there for about 20 years, and eventually when somebody started reading the reports from Congress as to what they were up to, namely mind control and time travel, they decided they better shut that off or they'd use it on them in Congress. So they were looking for a new home. They wound up at going to Montauk Point and selling it to the military, who were in the process of pulling out because they had run Montauk Point. It was built with the tower originally for the testing of the over-the-horizon radar systems, first the SAGE system and later the BMUSE system. And when both were perfected and BMUSE took over from SAGE, they started to shut down the base. And they arrived at the time when the base was in the process of being shut down and the military turned it over to the Germans, who took it over and inherited it. But at the same time, when the government gave them the authorization to use the base, they told them that they would be working also with some aliens who had some would be able to help with some of their projects, but also had some ideas of their own. And that was how the Germans got to the whole project up there at Montauk Point. It was given to them by the government with, of course, the proviso that they would have to cooperate with, and the aliens would cooperate with them. They were from a number of different locations. There were about 10 to 12 different alien types, and they weren't all there at the same time. They rotated. But that was how that came about.
Did that shock you?
When I first went there, yes, it did. But perhaps not as much as some people were shocked. And some of them were very friendly. Some of them were very human in appearance. But when you get an 8-foot-tall Draco, who weighs about 450 pounds and can speak many languages and obviously had a very superior intelligence and sort of looked down his nose at humans, A few he got to like and he was able to talk with, but his purpose was to coordinate all of the alien operations with the government operations there and to make everything work smoothly. And he was in charge of the aliens, of which there were many different groups. And, yes, it was quite a strange operation to walk in there and see humans. Young boys are being processed for the Montauk Boys Project, some of whom were very talented musically, and quite a lot of hit rock songs and other related musical work was done there.
Like what? What songs?
I do not remember any of the names now, but Preston Nichols, who was involved in this and had his own recording studio, knows all of them and knows or virtually all of them that were produced at that time. And these kids were never paid for their work that went into the general treasury of Montauk. But yeah,
would they be hits that we know if we heard
at
them?
At that time, yes. They were in the hit parade, if you will, at that time.
I know Wayne Newton must have been one of them, right?
Might have been.
I'm kidding.
I'm not into the rock scene. I'm not into much of the popular idiom of that time. I was very heavily into classics, and that, of course, became an interesting aspect because some of the classic music disturbed some of the alien groups very heavily.
Did you have the ability to look into the future, Al?
Not at that time. I went into the future, as I already explained, but to do remote viewing, that came up later on after I was out of Montauk. I was doing remote viewing and training remote viewers for the government. I've been in an awful lot of different projects, which are only slowly coming up.
I'd be fascinated to find out some of the things you saw into the future. And how far out did you remote view?
Several centuries, plus the fact that as part of that whole Philadelphia experiment mess, if I want to call it that, or there was a side trip, and there were later some additional side trips up into the 28th century to work with the survivors of the human chain and the human relationships and what survived the catastrophes that befell us between the period of 2010 and 2025. And the fact that there was a vast reduction in Earth's population and the whole structure of the planet almost came apart.
In that time period? 2010
to
2025?
And it took a century and a half almost 2 centuries to rebuild it after that.
Population right now, 6 billion. What was it like in that period then? Which is not too far away.
Down to about 300 million by 2025.
Well, which has always been what we have feared that these globalists would like to do. Is that what finally happened?
It was partly what they wanted to do and partly other elements which were totally out of control. They started it, but they couldn't control it after it got rolling. And, yes, that's what they want.
How did they eliminate the population?
It was a combination of natural factors as well as the use of the chemtrails phenomena, disease phenomena, the poisoning of the population through agricultural techniques, the use of the genetically engineered foods, and many aspects all combined together, and they overloaded the population and they overloaded the people. And, of course, in some of the other less developed countries, of course, their sanitation is terrible, and that is one of the
problems
that contributes
to it. Now, but you did say there was a boomerang effect, and things started to go back up again?
Yes, the population, well, it leveled off finally at around 250, 300 million, and there was a rebuilding effort which took several centuries. But the population never got over about 500 million.
The whole planet?
The entire planet.
My God.
That also put it in the category where the current planners want it. They don't want over 1 billion population because they say the Earth's resources are incapable of supporting on a continuing long-term basis population levels higher than 1 billion.
Oh,
and they're
true.
Essentially correct. We're straining all of our resources now. The water problem is becoming very serious in California, Arizona, and other places around the planet. Enough fresh water for agriculture, enough fresh water to drink.
Well, I'm not sure we have a water problem in California this week.
Not this week,
yeah.
No. They have a problem, all right, but it's too much.
Exactly. Let's take some phone calls. You ready, Al?
Okay.
Lots of people want to talk with you. Let's pick it up by going first to our first-time caller line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
This is Dorothy from Asylum Springs, Arkansas.
Go ahead, Dorothy.
Okay. George, I appreciate what you do. Al.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Right.
My father was possibly involved with part of the Philadelphia experiment.
Your father?
There was a Hieronymus experiment that went about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And Hieronymus was my maiden name. He was in the Marine Corps. He went through the first radar school that the Navy had, came out top of the class, and he was a genius in electronics. You know anything about it?
About the person known as Hieronymus? No. Yes, there was a lot of work done on radar, of course. Both the Germans did, but in our own research on radar started in the early period of World War II. Actually, it goes back to just prior to World War II. There was an experimental radar system as early as 1939, 1940.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the military got into it, and, of course, we developed good radar. The big break came when the British developed the magnetron, and it was brought to the U.S. and snuck in at Western Electric, and they started producing them. And then we had a quantum leap in the quality of our radar as a result of that in the period around 1941-42.
Yeah.
I know something of the history of radar, yes, but that was not particularly my forte at that time. I was a physicist in the Navy, and we did a lot of work on communications and, of course, the developing of the system of invisibility, which was a very bad project at that time, but was resurrected after World War II. The problems were solved by 1953 completely. And, of course, radar invisibility today exists. It works flawlessly now on any ships, any size, but it has been thoroughly covered up.
All right, thanks for that phone call. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir. Where are you calling from, sir?
I'm calling from Hartford, Connecticut.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
My question is the government still time traveling, and how, if they are?
All right, thanks, and we'll let you listen on the radio. Are
the
they still time?
Yes, they are still using time travel techniques, but it's under much more rigid control than it was. They ran into problems in doing some of the time travel. The earliest time travel system, believe it or not, was developed partly accidentally and partly by deliberate design in 1938. Before World War II started, and that was a Navy research being done on a brand new aircraft carrier known as a Kearsarge. And it's a very long and complicated story, but that was the open door occurred at that point to learn about time travel, and eventually, through intervention and help from some people in the future, because the Kearsarge disappeared for a couple of months and it came back, and it was undamaged, but. We learned about time travel and what the physics were.
What kind of equipment did they use for that, Al?
In the early days, then, there was an accidental discovery involving crystal emplacements put in the bottom of the ocean floor by the Atlantean civilization 12,000 years ago for massive transport of large payloads by ship, literally instantly transporting them from point A to B to C and what have you. So that gave rise to, later on, our teleportation systems as well as time travel. So if you can transport large objects instantaneously from point A to point B, if you know how to create a, shall we call it a wormhole, an artificial wormhole,
mm-hmm.
And this was what Montauk basically was all about, developing a very viable wormhole system, which they were very successful at doing when they finally got all of the wrinkles out of it. We traveled to the moon. We traveled to Mars before Montauk went down in 83. And I was in one of the crews that went to Mars. The wreckage, and I can give you some insight into that. The Martian civilization was very viable at one time. That, of course, is pretty well assumed by NASA and current scientists. But they had some kind of disasters there, and they retreated to the interior of the planet. They built a huge series of cities underground. The Martians survived from the estimated time period when the surface civilization collapsed at about 250,000 years ago. This is an estimate made by NASA, to the interior, and then the people that were left in the interior eventually died out, except those who transferred to Earth and became one of the Native American groups here on Earth. But the cities were all still there, and when we found a way to get there by means of a wormhole. There was a lot of massive exploration underground.
Hmm.
And, of course, we also had colonies on built on the top surface, which also gave rise to some of the requests for exploration of the underground. And the whole story about Mars has been so thoroughly covered up, it's unbelievable. Yes, there is water there. Much of it was contained on the inside, and that is the inside of the planet.
Is there life as we know it out there now?
Yes, mostly humans.
Underground?
Yes. There's huge military operations on Mars now. A friend of mine was part of it. That's why I know so much about it.
What you're saying is at this point, 2005,
yes,
we have been going to Mars.
Yes, we've been doing it for years.
My God,
we don't
pretty
use
darn
it.
Dramatic.
For heavy payloads, we can use spaceships, which we have developed sufficient for.
Why don't they want us to know about it? Why don't they just simply tell us? Hey,
it's
folks.
It's the old game of secrecy. I mean, you keep your population in control by not letting them know everything. And those who are on top who love secrecy, and they love to be on top of everything. And we know what's going on, and we know what's best, and the general population doesn't need to know about these things. Plus, I might add, there are aspects of the Martian civilization and what else they found there, which involves transport galactic-wise of the same type of wormhole phenomena. Part of it which was natural and part of it which was artificial. There were huge transportation links at one time in the past, galactic travel links using wormhole technology. And this involves older civilizations.
I'd love to see some pictures there.
I'm sorry?
Love to see some pictures there, Al.
Yeah, so would I.
Let's go to the phones again. What's next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from, sir?
From Dallas.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my grandfather was in the Air Force Intelligence. He told me a few things, but I was wondering if, do you think the Air Force or Navy, do you think they still abduct people for experiments posing as UFOs or extraterrestrials?
Do they have people?
Do they abduct people, like, in UFOs and then just have the population believe that they were abducted by aliens?
Oh, okay, I understand what you're asking. Yes, we have our own fleet of UFOs. We've back-engineered all of the crashed ones, and that's one reason they don't want the public to know the whole story, because we have captured enough crashed ones, including with the occupants alive, that we have been able to reverse-engineer the technology. We have fleets of our own UFOs. We have large spaceships. They don't want the public to know all of what's going on. That's quite true. And they want, in many respects, because I've seen, not myself personally, but I've seen some photos taken by people of UFOs over the Area 51 and such, which were supposedly alien UFOs, but they weren't. They were ours.
Just incredible technology.
Yes, we have incredible technology. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of the outsiders are looking at us now. Some of them enviously, some of them wanting to take control, others would like to wipe us out. And we're a thorn in the side of certain outside groups. And this business of who is on top, who's running what, and who's really in control of this planet gets to be a very sticky issue.
Do you have a website, Al?
I do. It's philadelphia-experiment.com. It's up, but it's not active at the moment because I haven't been able to get some of the newer inputs in on it. But it has a good website, and it has a lot of information regarding the Philadelphia Experiment and some of the background info.
Okay, now that
and
one...
I will pop up on it, products for sale, including my CDs and videos.
Now that one is yours. There's some other websites with your name. They're not
yes,
yours?
That's true. Originally, there was a joint operation with myself and a man by the name of Hopsager operating under his own name, and then we had a big disagreement, and then he started doing things with the CDs, which I didn't approve of, so we broke our relationship, and he continued it. Then he started to continue it as Al Bielek, the authorized website for Al Bielek, and then we pulled it because it was using my name without my permission, and then he just plagiarized it and called it Bielek.com, the authorized website for Al Bielek, which it is not.
Okay, it is not. Yours is philadelphia-experiment.com, which is linked up with your name on coasttocoastam.com. Great. Stay with us, Al, with Al Bailey. Al, how good now do we time travel, and I guess it's still secret, and do we have, like, a group of government time travelers, and that's all they do?
Basically, yes. After some of the problems he had in 1995 with too much experimentation with time and manipulating time and changing history, they ran into a lot of problems. The time field can be fractured, and they were almost at the point of doing it. So one of the big concerns of the government is that there shall be nobody doing physical time travel outside of rigid government control, because it has been tried, and all of those groups which were working on developing their own time travel equipment have been pretty well shut down. It wasn't that there was anything vicious intended, it was just that they realized that they time travel has to be very rigidly controlled and very carefully controlled, and only after a lot of consideration of what they're trying to do, whether or not it's viable or not, because too much playing around with the time field will cause its rupture. And if the time field ruptures, well, there goes part of our civilization or part of our history or maybe all of it. So it is very tightly controlled. Now, people who want to do time travel by mental projection, that's another story. There is no problem with that. It's the physical element of actually physically traveling in time from point A to point B and then possibly interacting with it. To go back or forward in time to only view something and not interact with it in any way is not so difficult and not so dangerous. The problem is that virtually anyone that does go through or some of the earlier government projects was for the purpose of interaction, to quite literally change history.
There's supposed to be an Internet time traveler. He posted things on the Internet a few years ago. He apparently has disappeared. Claims to have been a time traveler from the future by the name of John Titor, T-I-T-O-R. Ever hear of him? Or stumble across
him? Not by name, but I've heard of the fact that there was somebody on the Internet who claimed to be a time traveler from the future, yes.
That was him.
I've heard of it, but I don't know specifically about that person.
Back to the calls. Let's go to our international line. You're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Toronto, Ontario.
Great. Go ahead.
Yes. My question was, you mentioned earlier on in the show that a military officer relate to you the information that the government has the ability to manipulate space and time for pretty much any individual at any time at their own whim. And I just want to know if you could go more in depth about that.
I didn't quite get the nature of that question.
Basically, if you could just go more in depth about the conversation that transpired between yourself and the officer. About how they could manipulate space and time.
Okay. Yes, it can be manipulated, all right. It takes a much higher learning and aspect of the true nature of space and of time, and the physics that's involved with it. And very few people know really what goes on. They don't really understand the fact that we are living in a multiple reality universe, if you will. There are 7 parallel realities here on Earth. I do not know if that holds for everything within or without our solar system, but that leaves ground for manipulation there. And quite literally, one can go from one reality to the next if you have the technology to do it. The work was done in that respect back by the Institute of Advanced Study out of Princeton, back in the period around 1960, there about 60 to 70, in creating hardware and the technology in order to interact, literally go to another reality, and if you wanted to, live there. There are so many things ongoing in the more advanced aspects of physics, they never get published. There's only leakage by some of the people who have been involved, either directly or on the periphery, who wish to talk about some of these very advanced projects. Some of it was done privately, such as the Institute of Advanced Study, and that was a peripheral project. It wasn't involving specifically time travel. It was involving travel to alternate realities. The government didn't clamp down on that one quite so hard.
Al, if you had it to do all over again, would you volunteer back in 1943 for this experiment?
Hell no.
You'd rather have just lived out your life as Ed Cameron and...
Yes. I was doing all right in the Navy, and I was a career officer, and I had a family. Lost all of that. And I think my brother would probably not want to do any of it over either.
Did you track down your siblings?
Two, three, and four I have. Number one, I've never been able to connect with, though I was able to find out who he was and something about how we were just missed each connecting with each other and was blocked by government elements. Apparently he knew too much about the family background and my real history to be comfortable for the government.
Did your siblings believe you when Al Bielek showed up and said, hey, I'm your father from way gone back?
Yes, they did after a while. Number two and number three did. Number four, I think, is still having a problem with it. Number two and number three I met at a New Year's party on Long Island. I was invited to go out to see a group of Montauk boys. It was a town out there at that time, which was a sort of a holding pen for a lot of Montauk boys. Preston Nichols found out about it and told me what was going on. Why don't you come out for New Year's? I can introduce you to some of them. Well, turns out that some of those he introduced me to were my kids. And I didn't know it, and they didn't know it. It only transpired after a certain amount of psychological work at... were able to determine the fact that two of them were actually my kids. They didn't know it. Now, if either of them had known it, or I had known it in advance, I probably would never have met them, because the government didn't want me to learn anything about my real past or my history, my siblings, if you will.
Are you dangerous to the government?
In certain respects, I am. I know too much, and I have the capability of digging into super-secret projects, which... they don't want anyone to know about, and I keep turning up in the wrong place in the wrong time for their comfort, so I have had occasional problems, but they don't make any attempt to eliminate me, because that would be the easiest way to get rid of me, but to create more problems they could possibly handle, because I'm too locked into the time stream and too much time travel. They can't get rid of me that way. If I die a natural death, that's another matter, but die an artificial death, they'll get manipulated out of the space and time that I'm presently in, would create far more problems for the government than they would know how to handle.
Well, you keep getting into car crashes. You never know what's going to happen, so you be careful.
Well,
huh?
The first one I had on Long Island, in Florida, was manipulated and created for me because of the fact I had been digging into one of the other super-secret projects, and I found out too much about what was going on. I will only make a passing comment in that respect, and that is, go back and see the Matrix movies. You might learn something.
Good point. First-time caller line. You're on with Al Bielek on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm Dustin. I'm calling from College Station, Texas.
Hi, Dustin.
Hey, I consider myself a bit of an educated redneck. I'm a private patrol supervisor, but I've got genius-level IQ without the bell curve, and I just happen to enjoy my career.
Good for you.
Great. Yeah, I really enjoy listening to the show. I'm a phenomenal fan of Michio Kaku that was on earlier, which brings me to two things. I told your screener I could probably name about five or six, which has grown to about 10 now. But I was raised to respect my elders no matter what their opinions or platforms were. So I'm going to keep this really brief, and then I'm going to really enjoy the response off the air. Mr. Bielek here has put forth a fantastic story, but since he has some education in physics, he's used a lot of terminology. One he seems to have forgotten about is quantum paradox or the Mobius continuum, Mobius loop.
And, I haven't forgotten about it.
Okay. Well, it states, quite frankly and quite simply, that you cannot travel backwards in time. You can only travel forward in time
based on
quantum spaces.
It's not
well,
true
we can,
at all.
We can sit here and argue it, but there's one great thing that you could do, and it would prove once and for all to anybody, any critic out there. On your website, post the quantum equations to justify breaking the quantum paradox or the Mobius loop. You do that, and the story's over with, and everybody will believe your story. And one last thing, and I'll get off the air here.
Okay.
if you have this time travel and this power to travel back in time and to affect all the different changes you were, and no matter how malevolent this government agency is, surely you would think that in all the different tragedies and all the different events that have gone on, no matter who wants to be a globalist and reduce the population, just one of them, just one of these persons in one of these agencies might have used the power to affect some positive change, and they didn't. Just give it a whirl on those mathematical equations and make me incorrect on this. Until then, you just write a great fiction story.
Or make you a believer, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
Well,
and Michio Kaku or any other person out there would just jump out of their seats to see this equation and be able to proof it out. You guys have a great night.
All right, you too. Unfortunately, Al, I don't think you're a mathematician.
I was. I'm not currently. See, a lot of that was lost. And this is one of the problems with mathematics, just as a general statement. Mathematics is a great science. It has some problems, but nevertheless, it's a great science, but to be on top of it and keep up with the math, you've got to work with it all the time. It's one of the most easily lost technical capabilities because it does require regular usage. And if you don't use it regularly, you will eventually lose a large part of it. General physics is not the case. General electronics, that's not the case. But mathematics has certain aspects and areas which even today are not easily resolved, and there are some of the world's best mathematicians who spent years of effort in trying to resolve some of these unsolvable problems, so to speak.
How would you answer his question about you can't travel back into time?
That's a total fallacy. Like I said that earlier, you can travel backwards in time. The mathematics has been worked out in other areas to show that you can, and it has been done. It's been used to alter history.
Next up. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there. Going once.
Hi, me.
Hi, me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yep, go ahead.
Thanks, George. Mr. Bielek, first of all, I want to thank you for your courage and candor in sharing your story. I think it's wonderful to hear this tonight. I want to say that, you know, I think the government is definitely oppressively secretive, but basically I believe they're, you know, pretty much inept overall. And they have not cornered the market on alien contact for purposes of intelligence gathering and sharing. And my primary question, which may be to you or to George, is why in this day and age of communication technology are we in the private sector so seemingly unable to organize sustainable testing cooperatives for some of this profound alien information? And I speak on that personally. My dad was the individual, I don't know if you'll know his name, you may, his name is Warren Weideman, who formulated unleaded gasoline. And I myself have had numerous alien encounters that have given me a system of healing, which I've performed for free for 25 years and has proven to consistently address AIDS, diabetes, leukemia, cancer, and yet it's very difficult to find a venue where you can put to the test the credibility of shared information.
That's true. That's quite true. Now, I'm not going to say, and I'm sure other people wouldn't either, that all contact with aliens was nefarious. There are, just as there are in our society, people have good motives and bad motives, personal motives and altruistic motives. You have the same thing out there with the other alien groups. Some of them are very altruistic and may be here to help us, and there are others who just want to dominate us and take the planet back, claiming it as their own as they once owned it, as a quote and unquote. There are all kinds of problems in terms of not just human relationships, but human-alien relationships. There are those groups who want to control and dominate. There are those people here, quite human, who want to dominate society and our civilization. Look how long it took to get rid of the dominance of the king-queen relationship and start to give democratic governments and representative governments to the people.
And in some cases, that's still happening.
That's still happening, exactly. And it's so easy to end this, and there are groups on our planet today who wish to end that. There are the so-called, I'll use the term so-called, Illuminati, who some of them are highly intelligent without any question, but they want to dominate everything and control it to their whatever their own goals and purposes are. Some of them I consider misinformed in terms of their using their capabilities. Others I consider as just down outright wanting to just dominate the game for the sake of dominating the game. You've had this kind of people on this planet, both human and non-human. And you have a problem here in trying to weave between the two. And as we are having a problem right here in this country now with our the only country in the world that ever established a true constitutional government in modern times. It was an older one. It was patterned after the Iroquois Nation Constitution. And if you want to go back in history, you'll find out there are other older civilizations that did at one time have a constitutional form of government. But this is so rare. And in our modern day and age, the last 300-400 years, this was basically the only country that came up with a constitutional government. Eventually, the English switched over too, but they still have their monarchy. And right or wrong, they have it. I'm not trying to criticize them. But this is the problem. How do you establish a government wherein all people have fair representation and can express their own views and ideas, and it can be debated and votes taken on it, whether we should go this way or that way? This is one of the great experiments of history, and it's only quite recent. And if we're not careful, we're going to lose it here, too, because there are those elements within this country who wish to destroy it right now.
Yep.
Put us back into a dark ages.
Al, we're running out of time. We have about a minute left. And okay. One, thanks for being on the program. Your website, philadelphia-experiment.com, linked
right
up with coasttocoastam.com.
And I want to thank you for inviting me back on the program.
Well, it's been a long time, and I'm glad you're doing better. I got a little worried about you when I heard about that car crash.
Oh, I've perhaps it wasn't expected, but I've had 3 car wrecks in the time that I've been in Florida, and I've survived them all. The second one did no damage. The third one did some damage, but it was mostly to the car. It got demolished. But I have survived it all, and I am doing better, and I have some very good medical advice and doctors at the present time, and they've been doing wonders to correct certain situations. And, yes, I'm doing a lot better, and I'm getting back into doing some engineering, and we'll leave it at that.
All right. Al Bielek, Philadelphia Experiment. Thanks, Al.
Thank you.